This is Doreen Salcy, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to Stories for the Nighttime and Some for the Day. The Book. The woman returns from the store with an armload of books. She reads them quickly, one by one, over the course of the next few weeks. But when she opens the last one, the woman frowns in surprise. All the pages in the book are blank. Every single one. The woman takes the book back to the store, but the manager won't let her return it. "Right there on the cover," the manager says, "this book has no words and is non-returnable." The woman is angry. She wouldn't have bought the book if she'd known there were no words inside. But the manager simply will not relent. The woman leaves in a huff. She throws the book in the trash. A few days later, the woman sees a man reading the book on the subway. She gets mad. She screams across the crowded car. "There are no words inside. You can't read it," she says. But the man becomes defensive. "You can pretend," he says. "There's no law against pretending." "I think there might be words if you look at it under a special light," says a woman sitting nearby. This other woman is holding her own copy of the book. "That's so stupid," the woman yells. "Don't you see how stupid that is? Don't you understand that it's crazy?" At the next station, a policeman is called and has to break up the fight. A television crew arrives on the scene. The woman is interviewed. She appears on the news. She complains loudly about the book for some time. The next day, the book appears on the bestseller lists under both fiction and nonfiction. The woman is furious, enraged, appalled. She calls into a radio show and starts to rant. She calls the next day, and the day after that, and then the day after that. She appears again on television, this time in a debate with the author. "Your book is a joke," the woman says. The author just sits there and smiles. The woman becomes famous for opposing the book. She even writes a book of her own. Her book cries out for the destruction of the first book. In answer, the first book sales jump. The woman is frantic. She doesn't know what to do. She feels like she's going insane. And then, one day, on the street, a man comes up and spits in the woman's face. The woman stands there, shocked, paralyzed. She hadn't realized everyone hated her. She turns and runs sobbing all the way home. She locks the door and collapses on the floor. She crawls into the bedroom on her hands and knees and hides underneath the blankets. She huddles in the darkness all night long, her hands over her eyes, crying. The following morning, the woman unplugs her phone. She doesn't want to be invited on TV anymore. She sits on the edge of the bed for a while, and then slowly she rises. The woman turns over a whole new leaf. She turns her attention to other things. She takes up hobbies. She goes scuba diving. She even makes some friends. Without the controversy the woman's anger stirred up, the book starts to slip from the bestsellers list. It slips and slips for weeks and weeks, until one day, it finally disappears. The woman's own book disappears as well. the woman doesn't even notice. The years go by. The woman meets a man. She falls in love and gets married. She has children and raises them and lets them go and watches them start families of their own. She and her husband go through some hard times, but in the end, they stay together. And then, one day, late in life, the woman's husband dies. For months, the woman is unable to sleep. She wanders through the house, feeling lost. She turns on lights and turns them off. She sits down, gets up, sits. One evening in the attic, going through her husband's things, the woman finds a copy of the book. She hasn't thought of the book in years. She's afraid to open it up. Instead, she takes the book back downstairs and puts it on the shelf. It sits there untouched for weeks and weeks, until one day her grandchildren come by. "What's this?" one of them says, and lifts it up, and as she does, something falls out. The woman reaches down and picks it up. It's a single old photograph. It's a picture taken of her and her husband on the very first day they met. They're standing together on the beach. In the distance is a sunset. "Oh," says the woman, "look at that." And a smile spreads across her face. And then the book seems to open itself, and there's her life on the page. The Crown. A man works as a dishwasher. One day, as he is rinsing the dishes, he finds something strange in the water. He takes it out and looks at it, but it appears to be invisible. He collars a passing busboy. "Hey, what's this?" he says. The busboy takes it and feels it with his hands. "It's a crown," he says, and gives a shrug. Then he hands it back and walks away. The man looks down at the invisible thing in his hands. "A crown," he thinks, "in my dishwater?" It doesn't make sense. The man shakes his head, then sets the crown on the drying rack and goes back to work. Later, when his shift is over, he forgets all about it and goes home. But the next day, the crown is in his dishwater again. "This again?" thinks the man. "Why is this here?" At first, he's angry, but then he gets an idea. He dries off the crown and puts it on his head. He spends some time getting used to the feeling. "It's kind of nice to wear a crown," he decides. It seems to make him work just a little bit harder. He even starts to whistle a little tune. The days go by and the man gets used to the crown. He's never felt so good about himself. He actually starts to find himself looking forward to going to work. This is a new experience for him. The only thing that the man finds just a little sad is that no one but him is aware of his crown. "My crown is so nice," the man keeps thinking. "I wish it wasn't quite so invisible." Then one night at home, while watching TV, the man suddenly has a great idea. He takes off his crown and looks at it, or tries to. And then he goes out into the garage. He hunts all around until he finds the paint cans, and then he sits down on the floor with a brush. He paints the crown a bright, bright yellow, the brightest yellow he has. It takes him a little time to paint it evenly, but it comes out nicely at the end. The man sits there and looks at the crown in his hands. It is strange to see it so yellow. Actually, it's strange to see it at all. But in any case, the man finds it delightful. He can't wait to show it off at work. But the thing is, the next day, the man never gets to work. He is surrounded as he walks down the street. "The king! The king!" everyone is saying. "Look, everybody, it's the king!" The man smiles and tries to act appropriately, but the people are swarming around him. They are yelling and yelling. He can hardly move. Everyone is talking to him. "Oh, king," they are saying, "please help us. We need money and food and housing and more days off and a nicer flag and teachers and schools and tanks. We need a man to walk on the moon again. We need a better system of transit. We need bigger farms and a cure for cancer. No, scratch that. A cure for death." The man doesn't know what to say to anyone. Mostly, he just kind of nods. Pretty soon, he's in a long limousine with men wearing fancy suits. Everyone is talking very excitedly about things the man doesn't understand. He keeps having to sign official-looking documents and pose for pictures and shake people's hands. Eventually, the man is sitting on a throne in an immense room with tapestries on the walls, and rows of buglers are serenading him with big, long, shiny horns. It comes down to this. There is another country, some country somewhere, and they are about to attack. The men who swarm about the king's throne swear up and down to this fact. These other countries, did I say it was just one, are going to strike at any moment, and what is the king going to do about it? Will he or will he not unleash the bombs? The king excuses himself and goes into the bathroom. He stands there, staring into the mirror. "How did I get to be king?" he thinks. "All I wanted was a raise." The man takes off his crown and looks at it. It is quite silly, actually, now he sees. The yellow paint is garishly bright, and much of it is flaking away. He reaches out and slowly turns on the tap, then holds the crown underneath and quietly washes the paint away, scrubbing frantically with a paper towel to help speed up the process. Finally, when the crown is no longer visible, the man turns to throw it in the trash. But then he stops, having suddenly noticed that there is nothing in his hand. Visible or invisible, there's nothing there. The man turns and looks back at the sink. The sink, too, he sees, is completely empty. The crown must have melted away. Outside in the hall, the king's retainers are waiting. "I'm sorry," the man says, with empty hands. "I seem to have lost my crown, as you see. I'd like to help, but it looks like I can't be king." And in answer, the buglers all blow their bugles, and every man present, as one, reaches behind his back and holds out to the man a gleaming crown of solid gold. The Duck. A duck fell in love with a rock. It was a large rock, about the size of a duck, actually, that was situated off the bank of the river a little past the old elm. Every day after lunch, the duck would saunter off to admire the rock for a while. "Where are you going?" asked the other ducks. Nowhere, said the duck. Just around. But the other ducks knew exactly where he was going, and they all laughed at him behind his back. Stupid duck is in love with a rock, they sniggered. Wonder what kind of ducklings they'll have. But there was one duck, a girl duck, who did not laugh. She had known the strange duck for a long time and had always found him to be a good and decent bird. She felt sorry for him. It was hard luck to fall in love with a rock. She wanted to help, but what could she do? She trailed after the duck and watched him woo the rock from behind a tree. I love you, the duck was saying. I love you, I love you. I love you more than the stars in the sky. I love you more than the fish in the river. I love you more than. There he stopped, for he could think of nothing else that existed. Life itself, said the girl duck from behind the tree. She hadn't meant to pipe up. The words just sort of leapt out of her. The duck spun around to look at her. He was terrified. It's okay, said the girl duck, waddling out from behind the tree. I know you're in love with the rock. In fact, everyone knows. They do, said the duck. Yes, said the girl duck. Yes, they do. The duck sighed and sat down on the ground. If he had had hands, he would have buried his head in them. What am I going to do? He said. What am I going to do? Do? The girl duck said. How can it go on like this? Said the duck. I love a thing that cannot speak, cannot move, cannot... I don't even know how it feels about me. The girl duck looked at the rock. She didn't know what to say. I know, said the duck. You think I'm crazy. You think it's just a rock. But it isn't just a rock. It's different. It's very different. He looked at the rock. But something has to happen, he said, and soon. Because my heart will break if this goes on much longer. That night, the girl duck had a hard time sleeping. She kept paddling around in circles, thinking about the rock and the duck and his heart that might break. She thought long and hard, and before morning, she had an idea. She went and woke up the strange duck. Things happen when they must, she said, as if it were an extremely meaningful statement. So, said the duck. So I have a plan, said the girl duck, and I think that it will work. Well, what is it? Said the duck, nearly bursting with excitement. We will need help, said the girl duck, and it will take some time. And also, we will need a cliff. 2 days later, they set out. It took 4 ducks to carry the rock. They worked in teams and traded off every 15 minutes. Everyone joined in, even though they'd laughed, for ducks are all brothers when it comes right down to it. The cliff is over that hill and then quite a ways to the south, said the more elderly duck. I remember flying over it when I was a fledgling. It looked like the edge of the world. The ducks trudged on under their rocky weight for hours, and then for days. At night, they camped under hedges and strange trees and ate beetles and frogs. Do you think it will be much farther? Said one of the ducks. Maybe, the oldest duck said. My memory is not so good anymore. On the sixth day, the ducks began to tire. I don't believe there is a cliff, said one of them. Me neither, said another. I think the old duck is crazy. My back hurts, said a third duck. I want to go home. Me too, said a fourth. In fact, I'm going to. And then all the ducks began to turn for home. The rock fell to the forest floor and lay there. The strange duck looked imploringly at the girl duck. Don't worry, she said. I won't leave you. They watched all the other ducks flee homeward, and then they hoisted the rock onto their backs and trudged on. What do you think will happen when we throw it off the cliff? Said the duck. I don't know, said the girl duck. I just know it will be something. Finally, they came to the edge of the cliff. The drop-off was so great they couldn't see the ground. Just great white clouds spread out before them like an endless rolling cotton blanket. It looks so soft, said the duck. Yes, it does, said the girl duck. Are you ready? The duck looked at the rock. This is it, my love, he said, the moment of truth. And whatever happens, please remember, always remember, I love you. And the two ducks hurled the rock off the cliff together. At first, the rock simply fell, like a rock, one might say, like a stone. But then something began to happen. It began to slow, it began to grow, it began to change. It narrowed, it elongated, and it also spread sideways. It's becoming a bird, the girl duck said. And it was. It was becoming a beautiful gray bird, really not that unlike a duck. Its wings began to move slowly, up and down, up and down, and it dove down and then coasted up. It looked back over its shoulder at the two ducks on the cliff, and it called out just once, goodbye. And then it was going, going, getting smaller and smaller, flying off over the blanket across the sky. The ducks did not speak much on the way home. Do you think it will be happy? Asked the duck. I hope so, said the girl duck, and that was all. They really didn't say any more. When they reached the pond, the other ducks gathered around and clamored to hear what had happened. The duck and the girl duck glanced at each other. Nothing, said the girl duck. It fell. In the days that followed, the duck stayed to himself. The girl duck went and swam around in circles. She thought about that rocky bird flying off into the air. She saw it over and over in her mind. And then one day, not too many days later, she looked and saw the duck come swimming up. He was carrying a small salamander in his bill. For me, the girl duck said. And the duck smiled. The poet. A man sits down and writes a poem. It's not a great poem, he knows, but still he has written it, and so it makes him feel proud. Everywhere he goes, he recites it in his head. And then one day the man has a great idea. I will send my poem off to be published, he says. And so he goes and buys an envelope and sends it on its way. Many weeks later, the poem comes back. It has been rejected. the man is sad. I knew it wasn't a great poem, he thinks to himself, but still, I thought it was pretty good. A moment later, he becomes very angry. Who are they to say what's good and bad, he thinks. They probably never wrote a poem in their life. And so he decides to send his poem out again. The man sends a poem out many, many times, and every time it comes back rejected. This is crazy, the man thinks. The world is insane. What the hell is wrong with these people? So the man decides to publish his poem himself. He takes it down to the corner store and makes 14,000 copies. Then he wanders all over the city, handing them to people and taping them onto signposts and sliding them under doors and folding them into paper airplanes and launching them off buildings. He does this for days and days and days until finally all his copies are gone. Then he goes home and collapses on the couch. I have done everything I can do, he thinks, and turns on the TV. The TV is full of news about the man, or rather, news about his poem. Everyone is talking about it. Everyone. Everyone. People on the street are being interviewed. I think it's pretty good, one person says. I think it's a pretty good poem. It's not the best poem I've ever read, says another, but it is free, and that's good for me. I didn't like it, a third person says, but then again, I don't really like poetry. Bah, says the man, and turns the TV off. Just then, there is a knock on the door. The man stands up and walks over and opens the door. There is a very pretty lady outside. Are you the man who wrote that poem? The lady says to him. I am, says the man. Who are you? I am a writer for a famous magazine, she says. I'd like to interview you about your life and poem. Would that be okay? The interview lasts for quite some time. The man describes his childhood and his views on life and talks at length about his job and how much he dislikes it. So what's next? Says the lady when he's done with it all. Next, says the man. What do you mean? Next, says the lady. Next is what I mean. You know, what are you going to write next? The man frowns. He hadn't thought of that. He hadn't thought about writing more. I don't know, he says. I haven't figured that out. Well, says the lady, one thing's for sure, you won't have to self-publish again. When the lady is gone, the man sits for a while, thinking. Then he gets out a piece of paper and sharpens his pencil. He sits down and tries to write. He tries and tries and tries. But every single thing he writes is about the lady reporter. I'd love to go out with you, the lady says when he calls. When exactly did you have in mind? The man and the lady go out for drinks that night. The lady tells him all about her childhood and her views on life, and goes on at length about her job and how much she likes it. Have you decided what you're going to write next? She asks when they get to the end of the night. Well, the man says, if you want me to be honest, I don't think I want to write anymore. The man and the lady spend lots of time together. The man asks her to marry him, and she says yes. They have a nice wedding and buy a little house and settle down in the suburbs and have kids. 14 years later, the man writes another poem. He does it in the TV room while the kids are at school. When it's done, the man reads it over. "This one's even better," he says. And he smiles and locks it in a drawer. This is Doreen Salcy, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Doreen Salcy, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to Stories for the Nighttime and Some for the Day. Mystery, the Third Man. There were three men in the boat when it suddenly capsized, and the three men fell toward the bottom of the sea. "I can't breathe," said the first man. "I can't swim," said the second. "I don't know," said the third, "how we'll ever find the bottom." The first two men looked at the third in confusion. But just then, a whale came swooping in, and it opened up its big mouth and swallowed the three men. And when they woke, they were lying in its stomach. "Ah," said the first man, "I can breathe again." "We're alive! We're still alive!" the second said. There was a noticeable silence, so they looked at the third man. But the third man looked decidedly glum. "I don't know," the third man said, "how we got in here. And I don't remember where we came from. I don't understand how we're alive inside a whale. And I still don't know how we'll ever find the bottom." The first two men were disturbed by the third. They glanced at each other, then at him. They retreated to a corner of the whale's stomach to talk. "This guy's crazy," one of them said. "We should kill him." "Kill him?" said the other man. "Isn't that a bit extreme?" "Extreme," the other said. "This guy's insane. Who knows what he might do to us in the middle of the night?" And finally, the other man agreed. "Okay," the two men said, and they spent some time deciding how best it should be done. Then they did the deed. They strangled the third man in his sleep with their bare hands. And then they rolled him out into the deep. And the strange thing was, the next day, the men were saved. A whaling ship happened to catch the whale, and when they cut it open, they found the men inside. They took them back to land in a helicopter. And when the helicopter landed, the two men were famous. News crews came from all around, and they gathered about the two men and showed them on TV. And after that, they were as busy as could be. They went to many places and did all kinds of things, had many romantic encounters, and got product endorsements. On the surface, they were rich, and their lives were all but perfect. But sometimes, at night, things got bad. Because sometimes, at night, the two men dream dreams. And in their dreams, they saw that third man. They saw him as he was as they fell down through the water. "I don't know," he just kept saying, "how we'll ever find the bottom." And try as the two men might to ignore those awful dreams, the dreams didn't go away. They just got worse. So the men stopped sleeping. They began to deteriorate. Until one day they called each other on the phone. "I'm having these dreams," both of the men said. "Me too, they said. About the man. About the man. About the man, they said. We have to go down there, they said. So the two men hired a ship and walked up on the plank, and they sailed on out to the middle of the sea. And they put on their diving suits and climbed over the side and resolved to dive down all the way. And so the two men dove down. They dove and dove and dove. They dove until it grew dark and then went black. They dove until it was colder than the coldest cold they'd known. And they never once thought about going back. And finally, after many days, the two men reached the bottom. They shone their lights around and walked about. They looked around and looked around, but there was nothing there. But just then, a whale came swooping down. And this time, when the whale came, the two men weren't afraid. They'd been through this whole thing before. But this time, when the whale opened its mouth, it didn't eat them. Instead, the third man emerged from its mouth. Hello, the third man said, as he stepped down to join them there at the bottom of the sea. I'm so glad you made it. I have to say, I was a little worried. I was starting to think that it was never going to be. And the first two men looked at the third in surprise. And then they looked at one another. And after a while, they all started to laugh. And their laughter came out in big bubbles. And those bubbles, full of laughter, rose up and up and up until finally they reached the surface of the sea. And there they broke through and then just kept on rising. But to where is a mystery to me. The Granddaughter's Visit. Here we are on the swings together, just like when you were a little girl. Do you remember when we used to come here before you were in school? How you threw back your head and laughed at the sky. Push me harder. I want to go far enough to see the moon. Your tiny feet pointed up and down as you pushed the air to propel yourself beyond my careful two-handed pushes. Why won't you push as hard as you can? I can't reach the moon unless I go really, really high. I was afraid to push too hard, afraid of you being away from me for too long, afraid that if you were high enough to reach the moon, the stars, and all the goals that might take you from me, you'd be gone forever. But the swing brought you back again and again. And when you were tired at the end of the day, convinced you could try again tomorrow, because little girls know that there are enough tomorrows to string together a lifetime of possibilities, I'd hug you tighter than I should have as I helped you down. Then I blinked, and other pleasures took you elsewhere. Places where a watchful eye or outstretched arms to ensure your safety weren't needed. And you grew, and you left. And I watched. The phone, the front door, the mailbox, and waited as the momentum of your life brought you back to me for pieces of time that passed as quickly as clouds in the wind. We are on the swings together for another moment. You sit next to me and watch the sunset and feel the breeze, unseen like me, caress you before moving on. Thank you for listening to my story. The knots on the chair were perfect. I congratulated myself as I hummed, moving about the basement, making sure that everything was just so. Dotting your I's and crossing your T's is important because details really make all the difference. Can you believe your luck, Bernice, old girl? I thought, standing behind my seated guests, happy to see chairs arranged in perfect symmetry. The place cards, too, were well aligned and placed on the table along with envelopes, according to the seating plan. Really, nothing had been left to chance. The party was ready to start. Actual editors sitting at tables for afternoon tea, at my very own house, ready to listen as I read my stories aloud. It's a dream come true for you, Bernice O'Scribner. You've been planning this gathering for years. Airy Adney Smith, at the end of the rectangular table. A place of honor for the editor of The Butler Did It, the magazine to which I have mailed at least 30 stories over the years. Her envelope was befittingly the plumpest. Next in the seating plan was Stanley Speck Hubble from Cosmic Speculations, a legend in sci-fi magazines. It was said that he once turned down a story from Ray Bradbury himself, saying, "The content does not currently meet our editorial needs." I kept this in mind each of the 15 times I received a note in my SASE from Mr. Hubble. And now, dear man, here's an envelope for you. Round the table I went, looking at my eminent guests. Georgia Jones, editor of Southern Gothic. 11 stories sent to her over the years. Riley Oates. Imagine that, Tales of Suspense, who'd seen at least 6 really good pieces this month alone, and so on, until I'd acknowledged each guest with a nod and a shy smile. Giving the knot on the last chair one more good pull, it was a tautline hitch, after all, I was ready to read my stories to this special audience. I started with, "And Then There Were Some," a cute parody I'd sent to The Butler Did It. Then, "What If the Moon Really Is Made of Green Cheese?" a serious work I'd put in front of Mr. Hubble. Then, on to Vampires of the Old Dominion, a special story mailed off as part of a Southern Gothic theme. And then, finally, Imagine That! The World Is Flat! One of my best efforts. A little winded, I sat down to catch my breath before starting the last 5 stories when I heard the sound of wood splintering, followed by the most disagreeable shouts and curses. 3 police officers ran down the basement steps. They were followed by nosy Mrs. Curtis in 4B, who continually complains that I type too loudly at all hours of the night. Mrs. Curtis, not wanting to miss a potential bit of gossip, peered around one of the officers, stared open-mouthed at the silent members of my tea party, and fainted dead away. After the medical examiner peeled off her gloves and left, and the bodies were untied from the chairs, I sat handcuffed in the 9th chair at the table. My party was not successful, and I was disappointed. The poison tea in the pot was cold. The envelope stuffed with pink rejection slips were left unopened. And no words of praise had ever come from the editors I'd tried so hard to please. Watching the last gurneyed body bump up the basement stairs, I took a last chance of getting noticed and called out, "I hope I met the deadline." The woman, the letter, the mirror, and the door. One day, the woman gets a letter in the mail. She opens it up and starts to read. "I am your long-lost twin," the letter says. "Please, would you like to meet me?" The woman takes a breath. She stares at the letter. She has always wanted to meet her long-lost twin, but still she finds her hands are shaking. She gets up and goes into the bathroom. "Should I go?" says the woman to the woman in the mirror. "Should I go? Should I meet my long-lost twin?" The woman in the mirror considers for a moment. Then she simply shakes her head. The woman tears a letter up and throws it into the trash. She tries to go on with her life. She sits in her house and acts like nothing's happened. But a week later, another letter arrives. "Please," the letter says, "I've waited my whole life. I'd really like to meet you while there's still time." The woman turns her head in the direction of the bathroom. Then she grabs her keys and quickly sneaks outside. The woman drives across town to the address on the letter. She parks outside and stares at the house. She opens her compact to check on her makeup and finds the woman in the mirror staring back. "What are you doing?" says the woman in the mirror. "I'm going to meet my long-lost twin," the woman says. "No, you're not," the woman in the mirror says loudly. "You're going straight home right now." "No, I'm not," says the woman. "I'm tired of doing what you say, and I'm tired of always being alone." "You always were selfish," says the woman in the mirror. In answer, the woman clicks the compact shut. The door opens and a man is standing there. The man and the woman look at each other. They look almost exactly alike. After a while, the man starts to smile. "Would you like to come in?" he says. The woman goes inside. She stands there in wonder. The inside of the house looks exactly like her own. The woman can't believe it. She looks at the man. "What's the matter?" he says. "Is something wrong?" "No," says the woman. She looks toward the bathroom. "Do you have one too?" she says.
"One what?"
says the man. The woman looks at him. "Oh," she says, "never mind." The two sit on the couch. The man talks for a while, but the woman finds she can't concentrate. "Will you excuse me a minute?" she says, putting down her cup. "Oh, yes, of course," the man says. The woman stands up and goes into the bathroom. For a moment, she stands, staring at the floor. Then she steels herself and looks up into the mirror. But the woman in the mirror isn't there. There's nothing there, in fact, on the other side of the mirror. It's just the bathroom, empty, with no one in it. The woman looks down at herself to be sure. Then she stretches one hand toward the mirror. The mirror gives a ripple as her hand moves right through it. And then, there it is, on the other side. The woman pulls it back, stares at it a moment. Then she climbs up onto the sink. One leg first, and then the other, and then the rest of her. The woman moves through the mirror's frame. She emerges into the other bathroom. Then she turns and looks in the mirror again. And now, there in the mirror, the woman sees herself, just her reflection looking back. "Hello," she says, and her other lips move too. Then both of them begin to laugh. "Everything okay?" says a voice. "Oh, yes," she says. "I'll be out in a minute." "Actually, come in here," she calls out. The knob turns and the door opens and her brother's face appears. "Come here, come here," the woman says. He walks into the room. They stand before the mirror. "Just look at this," she says. For a moment, the two of them stand looking at each other. Then he smiles and she smiles too. "Can I tell you," he says, "how I finally found you?" And she says, "Yes." And her reflection says it too. The Seeker of Knowledge. The library was silent as the novice moved his feet softly across the room toward the great stacks of mystery. Dressed in saffron robes, Ravata resembled a golden moth in the moonlight that came through the monastery windows. Indeed, as he drew inexorably nearer to the ancient and forbidden volumes, he was drawn like that very insect to an irresistible flame. That the books were forbidden made them desirable beyond anything the young man had longed for in his short life. And he would read one of them, regardless of the cost. He would read the Book of All Things. Ravata thirsted for knowledge in the way of the young who are denied what they want most. Why were there secrets he could not access, merely because older, now dead, scholars had buried them in the dust of the centuries? It was his right, after all, to know all he could. If he was enlightened by the learning of the past, he, in turn, would assist in the enlightenment of others during a long life, particularly if that life lasted many, many years. Perhaps if it lasted forever. Of all the secrets kept from him, Ravata was most desirous to learn of immortality. It was a gift given rarely in nature, but he knew it existed, and the secret was his to discover, to be used to change his destiny. As a child, at the feet of his teachers, he'd learn that the sea, bottomless and dark, gave impossibly long lifespans to creatures who floated there. He heard stories that made his heart race. In the deep abyss of water, in the direction of the sunrise, lived glass sponges who were purported to live for 11,000 years. And the Ming clam, who shared the secret of longevity, was said to be born in 1499. How much knowledge could a human being have accumulated during centuries, let alone eons? Why should the prolonged lifespans be limited to creatures whose existence consists of nothing but the quest for food and the avoidance of predators? Ancient scholars had not only discovered the secret of these ocean dwellers, written the words of their discovery in a volume, only to decide that the knowledge was too powerful to share. It became forbidden, hidden in the topmost shelf in a library in one of 1,000 monastery rooms. The Book of All Things called to him in his dreams, invaded his thoughts as he meditated, became a taste in his mouth when he ate. Ravata must have it. It was his destiny. And here he was alone in the library at last. The robe slipped silently to the floor, and freed from constraint, Rivada began the arduous climb. 10 meters to find his treasure, placed for safety atop the collection of 84,000 scrolls and volumes. A leap to the top of the ornately inlaid panels gave him a foothold on the first level. Careful not to disturb the rectangularly folded parchments, he slowly made his way up the enclosure, stopping only to avoid sneezing the motes he breathed. Rivada did not pause in his pursuit of the highest knowledge. After many hours, he stopped at last. The book was within his reach. Rivada's eyes moved rapidly across the row of writings, seeking out the key to the rest of his life. He saw it, ordinary and almost indistinguishable from the other volumes of knowledge. It sat, dust-covered and modest in its simplicity. Perhaps that is the definition of precious secrets. Kept quietly present in the lives of those to whom they have been entrusted. Invisible silence, ensuring survival. Rivada reached out a trembling hand, unaware of the agitated shadow beneath him. His fingers grazed the binding of the book when a voice broke the night's silence. Stop! Go no further! To touch that book means death! And as his hand slipped from the book, his foot slipped from the shelf, and in the seconds before he and the tiled floor met with terminal force, Rivada saw the wisdom in those words. Thank you for listening to Stories for Nighttime and Some for the Day. This is Doreen Salcy, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.